Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 161. In the last lesson, we were in verse 14 of chapter 16, where Hagar fled from her mistress Sarah, and the angel met her, who was God himself, that is the one that became Jesus Christ, and she recognized him. And apparently she had seen him before that when he came to speak to Abraham, and we don't know how many times he came to Abraham. But obviously she was fully aware who that person was, and she knew exactly who that person was. And so we read in the account that she called the name of Jehovah, who was speaking to her. You are the El, or God, that sees me. And therefore she called the name of the place Be'er Lechai Ro'i. In other words, the well where the living one has seen me. And this is written in the scriptures, and everybody can read it. And yet when the prophet of Islam came about on the scene to the people of Ishmael, and also the people of Edom, as we shall read later on, there was a linking there between the two, at least in part. And he read the Old Testament, and they read the New Testament, and he came up with his own religion, claiming that Gabriel, the archangel, has inspired him, and he has the last revelation, therefore he's supposed to be the greatest prophet, greatest prophet that ever lived, even greater than Jesus Christ. And in his account, in the Quran, this is what the people who followed him believe to this very day, that this very event that we just read about didn't happen where it did, that is near Beersheba, right where Abraham lived, in the wilderness of Paran, but it happened in Saudi Arabia, where they have Mecca and Medina, the holy cities. Well, anyway, that's a different story. But we're talking about Ishmael and the differences between Ishmael and Esau and Edom. Ishmael, here we see, even before his birth, through his mother, is having a relationship with God. And God gives him his name even before he was born. You don't see that with Esau. You see major differences there. And therefore Ishmael, because of that, was of a totally different spirit and attitude. He did not depart with his mother when he was cast away, and he was 17 at the time, with great hatred, you know, murderous hatred, as Esau had toward Jacob. And he didn't have that toward Isaac. You know, Isaac was just a 3-year-old kid. He probably liked him. He was just teasing him, and Sarah didn't like that, and God worked it out because he wanted that separation anyway, so this was a good time to do it. And so the feelings there are not the same as with Esau and Jacob. And we cannot say that from that came a great legacy of hatred and bloodshed and murder, as it was, and we shall see, with Edom. And therefore the conflict cannot be, as we shall see from many, many passages, cannot be a Sarah, Hagar, or Isaac, Ishmael conflict, but it certainly is, as the Bible makes it very, very clear. And the scholars who have studied the Bible that should have known better, not reading the whole account, but instead they just concentrated on this passage here, of the story of the misfortune and the conflict in the family of Abraham, and based everything that they have understood of the present-day conflict on that. And obviously this is not where it is. Even though they had some problems along the way, you know, with Ishmael, but they were very minimal, generally speaking. He was not on their border. He went to his own countries, be it Egypt later on, and Saudi Arabia and other parts of the Middle East, east, in other words, of the land of Canaan, while Edom remained on the border, at least for a period of time. And then when many parts of Edom moved away, one part of Edom always remained there and still there to this very day. And that's where all the problems are. That's where the center of the conflict is, with the natives that remain behind, and not with those who are far away to the same degree, even though there are now and then supportive roles, especially in the last century. But we're not in the past in this matter. And so we read again in chapter 21, and this time when Hagar is cast away, And she has another encounter with God. And obviously, Ishmael is affected by that. All this time he has been taught by Abraham righteousness. He probably himself even saw God before that when he came to see Abraham. And you don't see that in the days of Isaac, in the days of Esau and Jacob. They did not know God, but Ishmael did know God. He was named by God. His mother saw God twice, spoke to him face to face. And so you see a totally different relationship there in attitude. And so we read in chapter 21, well, this time because she did not obviously properly teach her son Ishmael, and she saw him teasing, maybe she did not, but he was teasing Isaac, and maybe that's not the first time he had done it. And as later on the Apostle Paul would refer to it, you know, that Ishmael was persecuting Isaac. But what kind of persecution is he talking about? Not in the real sense of persecution. You know, as adults persecute one another, we're talking about a 17-year-old kid and a 3-year-old kid. So, you know, this is not, we have to understand it from the proper account, what he's really talking about. You know, some people blow it out of proportion. And in chapter 21, this is what we read, in verses 8 to 20. In verse 8, we read about the feast that Abraham made for his son Isaac, because Isaac was nursing for the first 3 years. That's a custom in the Middle East, and many still do to this very day. It's, you know, to a lot of people it may sound weird, but they used to nurse them at least two to three years, and after that they had a big feast, and that's in essence when he's beginning a new life. It's a new phase in life. And so we read in verse 8, and the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. And that was a customary thing to be done. At this point, the mother is no longer with the child as much as she was before that. Now, the kid is old enough to understand, to comprehend, to walk, to talk. And therefore, it is at this point that the father begins to devote more attention to the child and teach him the ways of God. All the ways of the adult world, whichever it was, in the society. And that's the reason for the feast. And so, verse 9, we see, and Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne unto Abraham, making sport. In other words, he was teasing, he was laughing. Now, you know, this is not the persecution, as I said, in the real sense, you know. What can a 17-year-old kid do to a 3-year-old kid? You know, just teasing. So you would not use that really terminology in the real sense, the classical sense of persecution. But she didn't like that. She didn't like the teasing. And therefore she said unto Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son. She really got furious at what was happening, whatever that was. Maybe he was making fun of him, but still. You can see that it was not necessarily vicious and malicious and wicked and evil, you know, as you find more with adults. And so she said, and probably moved also by God to feel that way and to think that way, because God wanted a separation. Obviously, for that to happen, something has to happen also to trigger that. And so, whichever is the case, she's moved by that, what she sees here, the teasing. And she says to Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even with Isaac. You know, it sounds extreme also when you think about it, you know, because one kid teases another little boy, you know, to say that he's not going to inherit with my son. You can see that God has an input here. He wants a separation, and this was a good time to do it. And we read in verse 11, and the thing was very grievous in Abraham's sight on account of his son. Now that's his son. And what she said seems to be very extreme to him. And obviously he's going to be very grievous, you know, feeling very grievous about it. He's not going to be happy. That's his son. He taught him the law of God. He, you know, hugged him, kissed him, you know, taught him and walked with him and communed with him and loved him and embraced him and all that. And suddenly, you know, his wife tells him, get rid of him. That's all, you know, obviously that's not something that a loving father wants to do. And yet you can see God getting into the picture, because he's really involved behind the scenes. Verse 12, and God said unto Abraham, let it not be grievous in your sight because of the lad and because of the bondwoman. Because, you see, he loved Hagar also. In all that Sarah said unto you, listen to her voice, for in Isaac shall your seed be called. You see? And so he's reminding him that it is through Isaac that he's going to give him all the promises and blessings. And for that to happen, it's best that there would be no others on the scene to create problems. And you see, that was not the case with Isaac and Jacob. You know, the two were together, and so there was a problem. One of them had to go. That's how you have peace. And that's how you have peace in the Middle East. One of them has to go. They cannot stay side by side and still have peace or have any accommodations, in the classic sense of accommodation. When two hate each other and have animosities and bloodbath and conflicts and frictions for thousands of years, you cannot have peace unless one of them is gone. And that's exactly what's going to happen in the future. And you can see what is happening with Esau and Jacob. That's exactly the case. And in the sense of the passing on of the birthright and the promises, even then, even if there was no conflict, it's best that only the one who receives the birthright remains behind. And so also this is what's happening here. And so God adds, and he says in verse 13, and also the son of the bondwoman will I make a nation. So he's blessing him. He's involved, you see. And that's why when Isaac speaks to Jacob in terms of passing the birthright, he says, may God, you see, give you all these things. But when it says to when he speaks to Esau, he doesn't invoke the name of God. He says, you're going to have to do it on your own. I'll give you a blessing, but you're going to have to go and get it on your own. And of course, God also helped him to a degree, as we shall read later on. But nevertheless, Esau had to do much of the hard work. Like Isaac, or Abraham before that, or Jacob, and so it is to this very day. God is going in the forefront of the armies of Israel, but he does not do it with others. And so this is what he said about Ishmael. Also, of the son of the bondwoman will I make a nation, because he is your seed, he is your son, you see, just like the others. It's not like those who, in their ignorance and because of their background, accuse Abraham of bigamy, you know, in the illegal sense, and then having a child who was illegitimate, and they refer to Ishmael. That's not the way God viewed it. He says, he's your son. He didn't say he's your bastard or he's your illegitimate son. He's your son. And that was his son, and Hagar was his wife. It's unfortunate that people read their own culture and their own bias and prejudice and bigotry at times, you know, and their confusion and ignorance into the Bible. And then accuse God and accuse the servants falsely, for which they're going to have to give an account when the time comes. Verse 14, and Abraham rose up early in the morning and took bread and a bottle of water and gave it to Hagar. And of course, he gave her also provisions. And he put it on her shoulder. And the child, and you can imagine the emotional scene that he was going through there. He loved all of them very, very dearly. It's not just like what you read here, which is just a sort of a summary of what's happening. And so he put it on her shoulder and the child was here 17. And he sent her away. And she departed and strayed in the wilderness of Beersheba. So this is where she strayed, and yet in Islam, supposedly this happened between Mecca and Medina. And so they enact to this very day, you know, once a year as they go there to their great feast, you know, sort of a duplicate of the Feast of Tabernacles. And they call it the Hijar, I believe. You know, that's a holy pilgrimage. And they enact this this story here of Hagar getting lost in the wilderness and running for water, and they literally go through that. Only they say that it happened in Mecca and Medina. Well, this is what happens when people read their own, traditions and their own stories and their own understanding into the Bible. And unfortunately, too many of us are doing the same. And we came up with the wrong conclusions. And that's the reason also why the scholars who do not understand the whole story, who do not read the whole story, who do not read the account from the point of view of God as He told it. So they read this account of Sarah and Hagar, and then they claim the whole history of the Middle East conflict originated here. And it did not. As we shall see more clearly as we continue with the story. And so she goes to Beersheba, and the water in the bottle was spent, and she cast the child under one of the shrubs, and some say it was a fig tree, and she went and sat down over against him a good way off, as it were a bow shot. In other words, about 100 feet, 100 yard, whatever. And she said, "Let me not look upon the death of the child." And again, you have to remember, he's a 17-year-old kid, a boy. And in many societies, a man already. So we're not talking about a little baby, a little child, a little kid. But he was faint, he's not used to the hot desert, and she was more resilient, more used to it. And so she said over against him and lifted up her voice and wept. Now, verse 17, we read, "And God heard the voice of the lad." You see, that's the name of the boy, Ishmael. God heard, And so this sentence that we read here is, in essence, the name of Ishmael. So when you think about Ishmael, you can think about him, about the man, that God heard. And there is a relationship there. And Ishmael keeps that relationship for quite a long time. Until gradually he goes into idolatry, and his descendants totally forget the teachings of their father Ishmael, who still for quite a while kept the ways of God. Some people may not realize that he may have been somewhere, wherever he was there, still keeping the Sabbath and the holy days and whatever his father taught him. He doesn't suddenly depart from it, because after all, he doesn't hold anything against his father. He loves his father, and he realizes what's happening here. And Hagar also knows what's really happening, and God told her, and so she knows that this is the will of God. A lot of people don't realize that what's really happening behind the scenes. And so God heard the voice of the lad, and the angel of God, and this is speaking about the one that became Jesus Christ, that appeared to her before that, and spoke to her, and she saw him. And he appears again to her, and we read here, and the angel of Elohim called to Hagar out of heaven. Now he's not standing before her, in front of her, as he did before that, the first time. He's calling from up there, and she hears him. And he said unto her, "What ails thee, Hagar? What troubles thee?" In other words, "Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad." So he's speaking about the father. So even the father, and Christ are involved, not only with Jacob, or Isaac, but he's involved also with Ishmael. A lot of people don't realize that. And so when the Arabs finally come back, the children of Ishmael, to the God of Abraham, and they call him Allah, and that's exactly what Muhammad, with all of his misunderstanding of scriptures and confusion, he knew the God of Abraham, the God of his father Abraham, and he was bringing back his people to the God of Abraham. And that's why they call him Allah, Elohim. Some people think that the Arabs worship a foreign god. Again, that's ignorance. They worship the God of Abraham. Abraham had only, one God, the God that dealt with him. And of course, Abraham knew by the identity of two, but both Judah and Israel, well, basically Judah, and the people of Ishmael that became members of Islam, they lost knowledge of the Father. And so they too think there is only one God. But he's speaking to her and he's telling her, the angel of the Lord, the one that became Christ, the Father, God, heard the voice of the lad where he is. He says, "Arise, lift up the lad and hold him fast by your hand, For I, the angel says that, I will make him a great nation. You see? So you see this constant relationship there with Ishmael, and you don't see it ever with Esau. And I have you now to notice that, because there are major differences there between the two. And so Ishmael is not holding God in contempt as Esau did. He's not holding the ways of God in contempt or the religion of his father in contempt as Esau did. You see? And he lets his mother choose the wife for him, unlike Esau, who does his own thing. See, these are totally different personalities here. Even though, he was being cast away with his mother because of his actions and also the attitude of his mother. But nevertheless, they recognize this is the will of God. They submit to the will of God. They don't rebel. They don't hate. They don't say, and when we have a chance, we're going to come back and get you. You see, they don't hold any grudges against Isaac. And even the prophet of Islam, Muhammad, wrote in the Quran, of course, the Arabs are not too interested in paying attention to it, but he made it very plain there where he wrote in the Quran that the land belongs to the sons of Isaac and not to the sons of Ishmael. You see, no animosity there. He understood that. He comprehended that. That's why, even though he persecuted to a degree and those who came after him persecuted, the Jews to a degree, still he had great respect for the religion and for the people. He gave them a secondary role, second citizen status, but still had respect for the people of the book. And they were actually the first one that he went to in order to try to convert them to his own way of thinking. And he thought they would be glad. But they rejected him, and so he got a little bit upset about them. Anyway, we see totally different men here. And God was with him, and God made him a great nation. And God opened the eye, we read in verse 19, her eyes, and she saw a well of water, and she went and filled the bottle with water and gave the lad to drink. So God is involved in all that. And Ishmael knows that, and he has gratitude for God, you see. And it's not what we see with Esau. Esau was consistent. And then we're in verse 20. And God, that is Elohim, was with the lad. And he grew. And so the lad knows him. Because you see, since Ishmael, who was 17 at the time, has been taught by his father Abraham all the ways of God, and is still keeping the way of God, therefore God is with him. And some people don't realize that. That Ishmael, in that sense, was converted to the way of his father. He was not converted by the Spirit, but he was walking in the way of his father, and therefore God could be with him. Therefore God could bless him. Therefore God could make him a great nation. But just like Israel, gradually he departed from the way. That is his descendants. And a lot of people that read this account, they don't realize that because they don't have any context or background. They don't go behind the scenes. They don't read between the lines. They don't study it from the point of view of God. They don't realize all these things. They just throw that notion there into the air. This is the origin of the conflict. And they really know very little about Ishmael and don't have much respect for him as they should. Yes, gradually Ishmael became a wild man, but he still retained a measure of the knowledge of God. After all, look at Israel, how often they departed from God in their wickedness, and still they were the people of God. And God dealt with them and sent them prophets and loved them. And he loved Ishmael. He heard him. He gave him his name. He was with him. He made him a great nation. And it makes it very plain. You see, the account makes it very plain. This is from the point of view of God, what the story is all about. Unlike those who read into it their own notions and ideas and concepts and misunderstandings and come up with their own conclusions. And so God was with the lad, and he grew, and he dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer. So now he's in the area of Beersheba, and then he goes further down toward the Sinai Desert, and then his mother, naturally being an Egyptian, takes him a wife from Egypt. And so we read, and he dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, which was further down from the Negev. And that was a territory also that the children of Israel dwelt for quite a while as they came out of Egypt. And so it says, and his mother took him a wife out of the land of Egypt. Now, the wife was from the land of Egypt. Doesn't mean that she went all the way down there, because after all, there were many caravans, and that whole territory at the time was under the domain of Egypt anyway. So there were a lot of Egyptians around for her to, you know, find a wife for his son. So you see, you know, he's an obedient son. You know, he listens to his mother. She chooses a wife. He doesn't do it on his own, unlike Esau, who did it all on his own. Didn't listen to his parents, didn't seek their advice, and he made them upset about it, very upset. So you see a totally different personality here, and we should take that into account when we study the origin of the conflict. Now, we read about Ishmael in contrast in chapter 27. In 27, well, before that, when Rebekah sends her son away to the city of her family to fetch a wife, because just like the example of Abraham, they wanted somebody from the family, and that was the will of God. We see already before that in chapter 26 and verse 34. Esau, in contrast to Jacob, and in contrast to Abraham, and in contrast to Isaac, and in contrast to Ishmael, his uncle, Esau does his own thing. And so we're in verse 34, and when Esau was 40 years old, he took to wife, see, it's not his parents that took the wife for him, as was the custom, and still is in the Middle East, in many parts, the custom of the people there, the parents are involved in the choosing of the match. And Esau didn't care about his parents, he didn't care about the tradition, didn't care about the, you know, the personal feelings of his own father or mother, or his grandfather Abraham, or the will of God. He was 40 years old, and he took to wife Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, contrary, you know, to the will of his father and grandfather. And then he took also Basmat, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. So he had two wives. In verse 35, we read the reaction. And they were a bitterness of spirit unto Isaac and to Rebekah. That's the way Esau was. Totally different than Ishmael. You see? That's what God said about Esau. Esau, I hated. Jacob, I loved. And so even before he was born, he saw that spirit in him. And that was a part of the struggle, which was obviously unusual. But you can see the spirit in both of them were contrary from the beginning of life. And that's where the conflict began. That's a real conflict there. We don't see it with Esau, that is with Ishmael and Isaac. You don't see any of these elements there. Total absence of it. And yet you see all of them. And the spirit of murder, and bloodshed, and violence, and hatred. And bad blood, you know, that was between Jacob and Esau. And they lived together for 17 years, you know, 70 whole years before they separated. And he went to Haran, you know, and Esau remained behind. And so that was a long life to develop an awful lot of hatred and animosity and conflicts. And then we read in chapter 27 that after Jacob was sent to fetch a wife from the family of Rebekah, the family of Esau, you know, of whom he couldn't care less, even though that was the will of God, that they marry among themselves and not from the foreigners, you know, that would lead them into idolatry. That's why the children of Esau were, you know, went immediately, shortly after that, into idolatry, while Jacob had a relationship with God, and Ishmael still was having a relationship with God. And so Rebekah in verse 46 of chapter 27, she says to Isaac, I'm weary of my life because of the daughters of Heth. You know, she was sick and tired of those wives that Esau took, and she must have had a lot of problems with them. You know, to the point where it says, you know, that they had bitterness of spirit, both Isaac and Rebekah, his wife. And so she says, I'm weary, you know, in modern language you say I'm sick and tired of that. And if Jacob takes a wife of the daughters of Heth, such as this, or the daughters of the land, what good shall my life do to me? That's how upset she was about what Esau did, who had absolutely no respect for his mother, no respect for his father, no respect, you know, for his grandfather, for the will of God. And so she sends him to Isaac, you know, he blesses him, and he sends him to the family of his wife. And so we read in verse 7, that is in verse 6, now Esau saw, that is in chapter 28 in verse 6, Esau is responding to that also. He said, we read here, now Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Paddan Aram to take him a wife from thence, and that he blessed him, and he gave him a charge, saying, you shall not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. In other words, he began to think about it, how foreign his actions were to him, to his father, and to his mother. So he had a second thought. And then we continue verse 7, and that Jacob listened to his father and his mother, in contrast to Esau, who couldn't care less about them, and he brought them a lot of grief. And you can imagine about, you know, how many verbal, you know, fights maybe they had between them, anger and conflict and frictions. After all, they still lived in the nearby, you know. And, you know, the story of the mother-in-law. And so they had a lot of problems there, those wives of Esau, with their mother-in-law. And she had a lot of problems with them. And Isaac didn't, you know, Isaac was very unhappy about it. So now he's reflecting on that. And he sees the contrast between him and his brother. And his brother listened to his father and his mother and was going to Paddan Aram. And Esau saw that the daughters of Canaan pleased not Isaac his father. He should have, that's a foregone conclusion. He should have known it a long time ago, even before he did it. And so Esau went unto Ishmael and took unto the wives that he had, Mahalat, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son. So he goes to his uncle, Ishmael, and he takes a wife that was the daughter of Ishmael, the sister of Nebaioth, to be his wife. So Nebaioth was the firstborn of Ishmael, and he took his sister. In other words, cousin. Now, that's interesting here, because what you see, as time went by, as time developed, now the children of Esau, as time goes by, they, in essence, they say, look, our descendants, our mothers, are Hittites, in other words, Canaanites, from the land. So that gives us a right to the land, because our mothers were Canaanites. And then also, one of our mothers is the daughter of Ishmael. So you see the link there between these two families, of Edom, of Esau, and the children of Ishmael. And so that gives them another claim down the road, again for the land, because they felt also that Ishmael should have received the birthright and not Isaac, because he was the firstborn. And then Esau himself was the firstborn, he should have received the birthright. So all these things are developed later on into the, you know, the thinking of these descendants of Esau. And that becomes a part of their folklore, you know, of their demands, or their desires for the land that they feel should have been theirs, and Uncle Jacob swindled it from them, from their father. And so they lay claim to the land. That's a part of it. And as time goes by, we shall we shall see more and more of that, because they intermingle, you know, more with the people of the land, and therefore to this very day, when you go to the Palestinians today, one of their major claims that they've been developing, especially in the last few years, and some of them seriously are going back into the background, and they have historians that are studying the matter, and they come up with those claims, you know, we have been here before you, you see, because we were descendants of Canaanites. We have Canaanite blood in us, and Canaan belonged to the Canaanites. And so many of them actually go back to religious rites of the ancient Canaanites to show the link between them and the ancient people, and therefore to lay claim on the land and to show that this land really belongs to them, and they've been there even before the Israelites showed, you know, in Israel, you know, as they came back from Egypt. So to this very day, you know, they recognize the links that they had with the Canaanites, and they truly did. From a human point of view, you might say, you know, if God is not involved, they have more claims to the land than the Jews today. You see? And it's ironic. And so this is what we see here. And so this tells you a little bit more about the origin of the conflicts. And there are many elements here. And you put all of them together and you begin to see a very clear picture. And then let's go now to chapter 36. And in chapter 36, we're going to read about the history of the descendants of Esau. And we'll touch on only one person here, and then we'll come back to this chapter, because there is an awful lot of information here, a lot of revealing information. But in verse 1 we read, now these are the generations of Esau. The same is Edom, because his name was changed to Edom. In other words, that became his nickname and then also his name. And he had wives from the land of Canaan. And he also married, in this case, I don't know why, but we have the names of the two wives that he married from the Canaanites, and then the wife that he married from Ishmael. And earlier we read that the name of that wife was Mahlat, but here she is called Basmat in verse 3. Ishmael's daughter, sister of Nebaiot. Why the difference in the name? I don't know. Maybe she had two names. And there they stress, you know, one name, and here they're the other name. Whichever it may be, those were his children. He had a lot of children. And then we read in verse 12, well, actually, in verse 9, and these are the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites, in the mountain land of Seir. Now, he went to a territory called Seir, which is at the southern end of the Dead Sea, and he had an awful lot of cattle. He was a very rich man. He was not a poor man. And you see, when you think about the blessing that God gave him, we have to take that into account, and we shall come back to that again later on. And he went over there, and he intermingled with his people. In essence, he defeated them, the people of Seir, Seir the Horite. And then after he defeated them, he intermarried with them, the remnant. And that was often the case with the children of Edom. Wherever they went, they defeated the natives, and then they intermarried with them, the remnant of them. As it is, that was a custom of many peoples, even the Israelites. When they defeated an enemy, they took their wives, that is their daughters, who were virgins, and married them. And they took their sons to themselves, while they killed, you know, the men and the wives. And sometimes they just killed the men in some societies, in, you know, Edomites or Ishmaelites, and maybe some Israelites have done even the same. Once you kill the man, you know, his wife is no longer married, so they took the wife. But generally speaking, God forbid that. He told them to kill all the married ones, every woman that had known a man, and to leave only the virgins alive, and they can take the virgins to themselves. Well, anyway, this is what Esau is doing here in Mount Seir, and later on we're going to find out that even though he went there and by the sword he conquered that territory, God makes it very plain that he is the one that gave it to him. As we shall come to that later on, and Moses will make it very plain. And so you see, you know, the blessing that Esau gave, Isaac gave to his son Esau, was truly a blessing, even though he had to go and do the fighting and be basically on his own in many ways. God still is with him to a degree, not completely forsaking him. And unlike Jacob, where he personally went in the forefront of the armies of Jacob, he did not with Esau, but at least he helped him to win the battle and to receive the land. Because that was a part of the blessing, and he too was a son of Isaac and was grandson of Abraham. And then he dwelt in that territory of Seir and intermingled with them. And so that name also became another name of Esau, Seir. And Seir means hairy, and Esav or Esau also means hairy, you know, grassy. So there was a link there between the two. And then he had a lot of children there. And then we read about one of the children. We're going to touch on this one here and then come back to this chapter later on. And in verse 12 we read, "And Timnah was a concubine to Eliphaz, Esau's son." Now, Eliphaz was the firstborn of Esau. And according to rabbinic legends, Eliphaz was a man of God. And Isaac, the father of Esau, trained this person in particular. Apparently, that's his grandson, so he saw in him something that he liked. And later on, this was the man, according to the rabbinic teachings, that became known as the famous Eliphaz that we read in the book of Job, who had the spirit of prophecy, one of the friends of Job. So apparently it was during the same time. Anyway, in verse 12 we read, "And Timnah was a concubine to Eliphaz." Now Timnah was a daughter of the Horite, who was the ruler, the former ruler that was defeated. So you might say she was from a noble background. And Timnah became a concubine to Eliphaz, Esau's son. And that's how they linked, you know, these two families by marriage. And she bore to Eliphaz Amalek. Now, the famous Amalek, everybody knows about Amalek. This is where he came from. Amalek was the grandson of Esau, from his firstborn Eliphaz. And Amalek, as time went by, also began to lay claim on the land. Because Amalek, as we read later on in history, biblical history, became a chief contender, or one of the chief contenders, of the birthright. Because see, his father was Eliphaz, who was the firstborn of Esau, and therefore he should have received the birthright that Esau should have received, you see, and not Jacob. And therefore Amalek, being the firstborn, you know, he thinks that, well, that birthright should have passed to him. So he was all along laying claim also to the land, you know, and all these are personalities that are involved in the conflict. A part of the origins of the conflict of the Middle East that has been going on for millennia and to this very day. And so as history goes on, you're going to see Amalek very much involved in the story of Israel. And currently speaking, it was bad. Not good relationship. We never see any example of ever Amalek having good relationship with Israel. Ironically, with Edom, now and then we see some good relationship. Sometimes they had even alliances between them, at least a part of Edom that remained behind. Most of Edom departed from that land as they grew greater in number and went on colonizing other areas. And we have a lot of history to show that. Biblical history and also secular history. And so Amalek became the chief contender for the birthright. And we're going to concentrate a little bit more on Amalek here, because there is a lot about him. Then we'll come back to the rest of Edom. Now Amalek, if you remember, when the children of Israel were on their way back to the homeland, the birthright, you see, that was given to them, there was somebody that was saying, "Oh no, you are not coming here." Now we don't see Edom at this point with this attitude. That is the rest of the family of Edom. Well, we see Amalek, who was a grandson of Edom, who feels that that land belongs to him and he's not about to allow Israel to come in into that land. So he was in the south there. And in Exodus 17, we shall go to that. And we're going to read another phase of the origin of the Middle East. And a lot of people, again, are very ignorant of that. They don't study the Word of the Bible as they should. And they make conclusions based on ignorance or bits and pieces of information, thinking that they know what they're talking about. And unfortunately, many people who follow them, they have misinformation. They don't really comprehend what's happening. And therefore, there isn't much knowledge and understanding of prophecy as there should be. And therefore, no comprehension of what is going to happen in the future. Or what is happening today. You see, you have to have all the name of all the players to understand what is going on. Not only partial comprehension. And many of us have partial comprehension because we've been misled to believe things that were not correct, especially in connection with this origin of the Middle East and the present-day players in the conflict. And the reasons for it. Now we read in chapter 17, in verse 1, and all the congregation of the children of Israel journeyed, that is in Exodus, they journeyed from the wilderness of Sin by their stages. In other words, they get up in the morning, you know, they pack their tents and they go on because the cloud lifted up, and then they stopped because the cloud had stood, and so they advance, in other words, sometimes, you know, a little journey, sometimes a longer journey, and so in stages, they approached closer and closer to the land of promise. And so they did it according to the commandment of God, and they encamped in Rephidim. Now Rephidim, that's getting pretty close to the land. And there they had a problem. A problem of water. And so God tried them over there, and we can read that story in the chapter. And then we read in verse 8, something very interesting. We read, then came Amalek. Now we just read about Amalek, who was a grandson of Esau. And therefore, obviously, was laying claim to the birthright. Well, we're going to have actually to stop at this point here and continue next time. This is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people.